Hi, everyone. Welcome. I am Colleen Wessel McCoy with the Cairo Center at Union Theological Seminary, and I am here.
Hello, everybody.
This is Willie Baptist, and we are excited to be with you today for this webinar featuring It's Not Enough to Be Angry. I'm going to say just a few words of introduction, but then mostly hand it over to Willie to speak, and then we'll have a time for question and answer. So I want to start with just a word about this book and its relationship to the effort to build a Poor People's Campaign. So on December 4th, 1967, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. announced plans for a Poor People's Campaign and called for the nation to take dramatic steps to end poverty. In the wake of his assassination, the campaign went forward but fell short of his vision. It was in the same year and context that King spoke the words from which the title of this book is taken. At an event honoring W.E.B. Du Bois, King said, "History has taught it's not enough for people to be angry. The supreme task is to organize and unite people so that their anger becomes a transforming force." So with the approaching 50th anniversary of that call, we find ourselves still experiencing unprecedented poverty in the midst of plenty, and unnecessary abandonment in spite of unheard of abundance. So Willie's book is part of building a larger response to the social crisis of poverty and a growing call to reignite a poor people's campaign for today that fights for the universal and God-given human rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Those who are taking up this reigniting are seeing that to succeed, we must build a social movement to end poverty led by the poor as a united social force. And to do that, we must develop and unify a core of committed and competent leaders. This book is part of the curriculum to support that development. So many of you know Willie Baptist. Some of you know him very well. But I wanted to say that just to do a brief introduction to him for those who don't. Willie Baptist is a formerly homeless father of three who came out of the Watts uprisings and the Black student movement. He has 50 years of experience educating and organizing amongst the poor and dispossessed, including working as a lead organizer with the United Steelworkers, as an educator and organizer of the National Union of the Homeless and its educational arm, the Annie Smart Leadership Development Institute, and as the educational director of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union for 10 years, and as lead organizer and educator for the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, as well as many other networks. He is a board member of the National Welfare Rights Union, United Workers of Maryland, Picture the Homeless in New York, and on the advisory committee for the Wildfire Project. Willie is the author of numerous books, articles, and pamphlets, including Pedagogy of the Poor, A New and Unsettling Force, It's Not Enough to Be Angry, and Lessons from the Poor Organizing the Poor. Willie presently serves as the Poverty Initiative Scholar in Residence and co-coordinator of the Poverty Scholarship and Leadership Development for the Cairo Center. So now I'm going to turn it over to Willie. Please remember to use the chat feature for any questions you may have. And thank you to all for being here today.
Okay. Hello, everybody. This is relatively new exercise for me using technology. I'm still horse and buggy, and so I'm still trying to make out how to use these things. In these times, using advanced technology and using advanced media is absolutely critical if we're going to be successful. Those who master these new technologies are going to be successful. I mean, in other periods in history, like during a period against in the struggle against slavery, people like Frederick Douglass really mastered the media of his time. He was the editor of the North Star, and Frederick Douglass named after him. His writing and his speaking and the kind of leadership he provided largely was put forth and very effectively and expressed very effectively by his mastery of media at that time. So I'm going to have to figure out how to master this media. So this is the first time. So if people can bear with me, then we could try to get as much as we can out of this experiment for me. From my book, I'm drawing on four main points. There are many points that are touched on in that essay, in a series of essays or a set of essays in that book. But I'm going to bring out four main points in my initial discussion, and then we can bring up any of the other points that people wish to bring up besides the four main points that I'm bringing up right now during the question and answer period. The four points are: one, the significance and lessons of the 1965 Watts Uprising. I think it holds tremendous lessons. I'm still a student of that period. I was 17 years old when that, living in Watts, South Central LA, at that time in 1965. The second point is, what is a leader? We want to talk about leadership as the art of the possible. The third point is why the title is not enough to be angry. Why this book has that title. And then the last point is why the need to unite the poor and dispossessed today, domestically and globally. Why is that such a critical point of departure for our efforts today in every aspect of our struggles and work that we're doing on every front of activity? Why is it absolutely necessary that we unite with the poor and dispossessed? Of course, one of the means in which the Carroll Center, the Poverty Initiative, is using and helping, is putting out there for people to discuss and debate, is this call to reignite Reverend Dr. King's, Dr. Martin Luther King's Poor People's Campaign. That we see that he was very prescient, and that his carrying out that aspect of organizing it in the last part of his life is still relevant today, even more so on a global level as well. So anyway, those are the four points I want to speak to in my opening remarks. Let's begin. On August 11, 1965, some 40,000 to 60,000, and some estimates are as high as 100,000 people hit the streets of Watts, California, in South Central LA. This Watts was one of the poor, if not the poorest community in the entire state. It was largely a Black community, almost totally a Black community, but it was an impoverished section of the Black community. There were other Black communities in the area, namely Baldwin Hills, which we called the Black Beverly Hills at that time. It was made up of middle-class, middle-income professionals. They were subject to police relations that profiled Blacks, and they were picked up. But the concentration, the high concentration of police relations, bad relationship, or police brutality and killings was in the Watts area. That area erupted. The underlying factors involved, which is not spoken to very often, is the economics. It was the ghetto, the Black ghetto. And you're talking about deprivation. Job situation was very poor. As a matter of fact, among the youth in Watts at that time, you had somewhere upwards of anywhere between 60-70% unemployment among the youth. And the Watts Uprising inaugurated a whole period of major uprisings in the country. Some 300 cities broke out in violent protests against the inhumane and insane human conditions that existed in these Black ghettos. And every one of these cases, just about everyone, was ignited or triggered by bad police relations, which in my looking at Watts and drawing the lessons is that bad police relationships are related to bad economic circumstances. And I think those circumstances are asserting themselves today. And I think we're seeing bad police relationships beginning to go for, to increase. and incidents of police brutality and police killings are something that we can expect as long as those relationships, the economic relationships, continue to deteriorate. The thing about that uprising is that after the first 2 days, the police force, which was a standing force of about 60,000 to 7,000 policemen. And because of that, the outbreak all over the area, not just in the West community. Now, the West community is a smaller area with about 40,000 to 50,000 residents. But the police, because of the outbreaks going beyond the technical boundary of West, was broadened, and they cordoned off a larger area that was mostly, you know, black population. But you're talking about a residency of anywhere between 400,000 to 500,000 people. And you had breakouts in Watts, and you had breakouts all throughout that whole area. The police had to deal with that mass of violent protests. And with a force of 6,000 to 7,000, they couldn't handle it. Because the basic principles of strategy and tactics is how do you combine 10 or mobilize 10 against one? How do you attain a majority? And only having 6,000 to 7,000 policemen, there's no way that they could deal with the amount of people that was erupting as a result of the economic conditions that were prevailing in Watts at that time. And so, you know, after the first couple of days, the police force was rendered null and void, and they had to bring in bigger forces, the National Guard, to contain that situation. Of course, when we heard through the grapevine of the fact that the police had to retreat, those of us, the youth, I was 17 years old during that period, you know, we had bonfires throughout Watts. The conditions that had developed economically, and then the police relationship was horrible. There was cases and rumors and all kinds of incidents of police brutality, including cases where a 15-year-old black woman, a black young girl, was brought into a police car and raped by the police. There was cases after cases where black adults and black youth were stopped by the police and was asked to go for their identification card. When they reached for the identification card, they were shot to death point blank range. And with the excuse that the police were thinking that he was going for his gun. These are the cases over and over again that we heard in throughout the Watts area, but the greater black community as well. And there was, you know, incidents in the brown community, in the Chicano communities as well, but largely the outbreaks took place in these black ghettos. And like I said, it inaugurated a whole period of upheavals throughout the country in over 300 some cities that erupted from 1965 on into 1968 with the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. You saw this massive outpouring. Sociologists and historians have labeled that period as the greatest, most forceful and violent mass social upheaval since the Civil War, a U.S. Civil War. I mean, this is something of real significance. It was heard around the world. I mean, you know, as a matter of fact, the people of Watts got an open letter from the Vietnamese brothers and sisters who were fighting for their lives in Vietnam at the time during the Vietnam War, thanking the Watts community for doing what it did, because for that to happen, the order was among the armed forces based in San Diego was to hold off the shipping of troops to Vietnam, and they held them off for about 2 weeks on alert. And the Vietnamese leaders was aware of that. And there was an open letter, I recall, during that period that we heard that the Vietnamese thanked us for doing what we did. Of course, like what Martin Luther King pointed out, the uprising that took place there, as well as throughout the whole country in Newark and Detroit, I mean, these were massive upheavals and fights that was happening between the police and in these ghetto communities. The people there could really appreciate what was going on during that period. on a worldwide scale. And I'm still, like I said earlier, I'm still a student of the period. Of what were the conditions that gave rise to the Watts uprising, and then that igniting around the country other uprising? What are the conditions? What are the economic, social, and political conditions that was involved in that process? My estimate is that understanding is absolutely crucial to understanding what is about to happen in this country, what's beginning to happen in this country, and what is happening worldwide, because the conditions that obtained in Watts during that period, the unemployment among the youth, the deteriorating economic circumstances, are circumstances that we are dealing with today. But these circumstances are not just limited to the Black ghetto. This is happening in white communities, slum areas. The white community is spreading. The conditions of unemployment, eviction, is happening all over the place. And the Latino community, and also worldwide. You hear about the situation in Europe with Greece and Spain, but also in Latin America. You're seeing instability beginning to take place, largely because the conditions that gave rise to Watts are with us and are spreading, and it's getting worse. And so the powers that be, no doubt, are burning midnight oil to figure out how to preempt or prevent any kind of coagulation that would be such a threat to the process in status quo today. And this is the circumstances in which we are operating. And the book, this is one of the main points that the book was making. I should also add that in that those uprisings, there were three main responses. One was this all-white, all-class law and order backlash that took place, that was agitated for people like Ronald Reagan. He got his inauguration in terms of politics during this period. He ran for governor of California on the basis of a platform that was an agitation against these Black criminals that was erupting in Watts. And he came in on a law and order platform. And that, among other efforts, was a rallying point for this all-white, you know, across-class backlash that took place during that period. They eventually gave rise to the, you know, moral majority and the religious right. And those elements trace, you know, their developments, a lot of it, their developments from this period. The second response was this, the Black Power movement, which I got caught up in. I was part of that Black Power movement, the Black student element of it. I helped found the Black Student Union at Pepperdine College in South Central, when it was in South Central. And I was on a baseball scholarship there. And that was my involvement largely, besides being involved with the uprising itself. But I became part of that Black Power movement, which ultimately elected Black elected officials. It was used to channel that kind of motion into the election of a whole Black establishment, if you will, in terms of elected Black officials. The third response was neither this kind of white power response or the Black power response. It was a response to the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King at the urgings of Robert Kennedy to organize a Poor People's Campaign. And Martin Luther King was very clear during that period that it would be more apt, given the suffering that was happening even in those times, to have power to go to poor people. That is organization, that is unity, that is a voice that is directed toward poor people, then as a whole, across color lines. Everybody who hurt, everybody who's dispossessed and repressed need to be united together. Now, of course, the political police, that is the FBI particularly, was involved with all three of those responses. It helped and aided the so-called white power law and order camp process, and it used that to help ignite and keep going and keep agitating for the Black power. It was involved with that. Their destruction of the Panthers is well known in that whole movement, and other things that they did during that period with the COINTELPRO. And so you had that involvement where they used the Black power struggle to reinforce the white power, and they used the white power to reinforce the Black power. So you had this kind of reaction that was taking place during during that period. Of course, the Kerner Commission, their assessment of what the problem was that the problem was one of contradiction between a white nation and a black nation. And the economics of it, the class element of it, was obscured in that whole process. Where Martin Luther King, he understood not only the race aspect and not only the military, because the Vietnam War was happening at that point, but he also understood the economics of, and that these things were all inseparable. And so he saw that that to deal with all these issues that are affecting much broader, much larger sections, just blacks, that you can unite the people who are most hurting, that they can become an new and unsettling force, a rallying force for the rest of the people in that period around this the critical issues of militarism, of racism, as well as economic impoverishment. These are the separate issue, and that by uniting, having this third response go forward, that that would be the way to respond to what he called the so-called riots as being the voice of the poor, but that if the poor can be organized in a nonviolent army, they can become a rallying point for the rest of the nation to move this country forward. Well, of course, Martin Luther King was assassinated. And the 1999 trial, which very few people know about, that happened in Memphis on Martin Luther King's assassination proved without a doubt. The jury voted, ruled in favor of the notion that this was a result not of the so-called poor white James L. Ray, that he was just a posse, that the real involvement was a conspiracy at every level of government, from the FBI, to CIA, to military intelligence, to local intelligence and the local police. All of them was in the vicinity at the time of his shooting. And there was an expert who actually assassinated him. And that James L. Ray had no expertise in terms of a gun shooting it from that level. And as a matter of fact, when you every year when we celebrate the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday, there's this picture, iconic picture, of Dr. King lying on the balcony, hadn't been shot, and his lieutenants pointing in the direction of where the shot came from. And there was one gentleman, however, Mayor McCullough, who was, he was the only one that wasn't pointing. He was kneeled down. Turns out he was testing the vitals of Dr. King. His name was Mayor McCullough. And it turns out that Mayor McCullough was a member of the military intelligence. And people say today that he's somewhere in Africa, working with the Central Intelligence, CIA, the case that the family, the King family brought against one of the participants of that of the assassination, that case proved this wider development, and that was a real concern for the powers that be was the fact that he was uniting the poor whites or poor blacks, poor Latinos, into a unity in raising issues and concerns that affect the morale of the poor who are at the forefront, you know, taking all the hits in terms of racial killings at Vietnam, as well as taking the hits at home in terms of lack of housing, lack of decent jobs, and so on. That, you know, in the richest country in the world would help really awaken people. He'd call, again, this force new and unsettling force. So those are the three responses, which I think there's a lot of lessons today. Because when we look at what's happening today with this, the question of race, the question of economics, and the question of military, and we would add from the Carroll Center, in our analysis, we see the ecology has emerged as this four eagles. Dr. King talked about the three main eagles at that time. But now this question of toxic waste and just the ecological conditions that are affecting the poor, but increasing other sections of the population in a very dreadful way and very deadly way. Anyway, these four evils, King talked then, and what we would have to talk now, and this is what the book speak to or the essay speak to, is that we have to talk about dealing with all those issues as inseparable, not having everybody rely on just one aspect and another aspect and thus fragment our efforts and thus, you know, be subject to manipulation, easily manipulated against each other, imploding against each other, as opposed to building a force that can deal with bettering our society and changing the status quo, which is killing increasing numbers of the population here in the United States and worldwide. That WASP uprising was a point raised in the essay that I think I wanted to really emphasize, because I think it still has lesson today. And like I said earlier, I'm still a student learning from that, because you can see throughout my lifespan, I'm 67 years old, I see the similar patterns. When the economics tends to unite us, the economics don't care who you are, they'll, you'll get laid off, you'll get evicted, or you go through these problems. You know, there's a disproportion, because the history of race in this country, there's of course a disproportion. But the reality is that every section of the population is being affected more and more as we go forward. And the question is, are they going to be able to unite each other, or are they going to be polarized into this black and white camp and so forth? So that's the first point, the significance and the lessons that can be drawn from the WASP uprising. The spirit of WASP is here with us again, and it's something that we should understand, so that we don't have to repeat history and go through the same game that they play, pitting one section of the poor against the other section of the poor. The second thing is, second point that I want to raise is this question of what is leadership? Leadership, being a leader, is someone who's about solving problems, but solving problems based on the means at hand, which ultimately means leadership in life is, in general, is about the art of the possible. You can dream the impossible dream, but you can't do the impossible. And the only way you're going to be able to deal with the possible is to make an assessment of what in the hell you're dealing with. And this assessment is something that is crucial if leaders are going to come together to carry out a task of uniting the dispossessed and not having them fighting against each other and pitted against each other in a way that we know that the powers that be are prepared to do. Because, they only represent 1%. And the only way you can control 99% is to emphasize their differences and then to manipulate them on the basis of those differences. And we are seeing those patterns, throughout American history, but also recent history emerging in terms of the tactical options that the powers that be are relying on today. But anyway, the understanding those realities, understanding the conditions, that we have to operate within, is something that's absolutely critical. I think a lot of the burnout is due to a lack of perspective and an understanding of what is possible and what is impossible. So you can avoid the impossible and really go at the possible. Now, part of that impossibility has to do with the forces that are lying against us, because the forces that are lying against us are in power, and they have at their disposal every leverage of power and influence, from the military to the police to the court system to the TV and media. They have all these things at their disposal, and they use all those things to try to preempt and prevent any kind of coagulation of a critical mass that can actually threaten the status quo at this point, because people have a vested interest in the status quo. They're not going to give it up. In history, when you had slavery in this country, there was a slave power and a slave capital that fought like hell, a civil war, to prevent the changing of the status quo. But in every stage of this country's history, the British Crown fought like hell to keep the colonies. But it's the colonies that had to make that fight. But to make that fight, they have to understand who they're up against, who they were, and understand the possibilities of the time, and as leaders, be able to point to those possibilities and move on that. Otherwise, what you do is try to attempt the impossible. And I tried it. I mean, I've been involved nearly 50 years in the struggle, especially in the impoverished community and shelters and so on. I've been homeless myself, as was mentioned earlier. And I just know that that you got to have a perspective. I had, in the course of almost 50 years, I had 2.5 to 3 nervous breakdowns. And when I look back on that period, I look at it as one that where I had no perspective, had no strategic perspective to really gauge how much energy should I deploy in this situation or that situation. I just took on every task, man. I was overworked. I was 24/7. I was committed to the struggle. We came out of the 60s with this sense of social responsibility, and everything that affected me, including the Watts Uprising, gave me this kind of social consciousness. So I was really concerned, not just about myself, but about the people who are hurting all over the country. So whatever task came before me, I took it up and I just added it on. And you could only do so much by yourself. This idea of being a Superman or Superwoman is bullshit that we get over the TV and all that kind of bullshit. You know, the Ford, Fantastic Four, that's unreality, that's fantasy. The reality is that we have ourselves, and you can't do anything by yourself. You have to begin to coagulate, to organize and bring people into motion on things they are hurting, issues that hurt them. They need to be organized to do so. That makes the accomplishment of a task possible. And again, the estimate of the situation is absolutely critical. Right now, this is probably the most important contribution we can make, and that is, you know, really engaging in strategic dialogue with one another, making analysis of what we're up against, who we are, what are our strengths and weaknesses, what is the strength and weaknesses of the forces that we're up against as we fight to change the status quo. That's a critical thing, especially in a culture like ours. And this is what the book, the essay, raised, is that we're dealing with a culture that's anti-theory, anti-intellectualism. It's about do. It's about shooting, then aiming. It's about leaping, then looking. We don't have time to think. We have to just proceed out of emotion and out of sentimentalism, and not out of a kind of sophistication that really matches the sophistication of the people we're up against. If you study history, and this is another point raised, you'll never find in world history where a dumb force rose up and defeated a smart force. Never. You know, I don't care. Even with Alaric, you know, who was the leader of the Visigoths, he sacked Rome based on his analysis of the situation in Rome. The forces had shifted from Rome to Byzantine. He knew that at that moment he could attack Rome and defeat Rome at a certain time. And he had mastered the strategies and tactics of the Roman army because he was part of the Roman army for a while there. And so he outsmarted them. He didn't just outfight them. And if we're going to win against the forces that we're up against, and these are very sophisticated forces, and you got to respect that. We got to know them. We got to know ourselves. We got to respect that knowledge is power. And we just can't go into a struggle with our head down, with no perspective, no strategic understanding, and therefore subject to burnout, to nervous breakdowns. And so when the moment come, when we need to be there, giving a commitment and clarity, we're out of the box because we've exhausted. We've become frustrated with the fact that we can't accomplish what we're trying to accomplish, and we go into a resignation. And that recognition leaves us at a moment when leadership is absolutely critical. W. Du Bois, I think the greatest intellectual that this country has ever produced. I'm not talking about just black intellectual. I'm talking about intellectual, period. His magnum opus, Black Reconstruction, one of the main lessons that he draw on that, this very critical moment in American history, that is the Reconstruction period, is that that was a missed moment, that what was needed in that period was people who had the intelligence and the unselfishness, who can understand what was the possibilities that could be taken advantage of in order to move the situation forward. And of course, he wrote that book in 1935. So he wrote it for the public during the Great Depression, when there was a massive economic and social dislocation, and you had massive general strikes taking place. And he's trying to say for the people in the 30s about the struggle in the 1860s, 70s, that there are similar parallels and that we don't want to miss the moment. Now, in order not to miss the moment, you got to have people who understand the moment. You got to have this relationship, like the essay point out, of consciousness that understand the conditions and what that conditions make possible. It's so critical, especially when you're talking about strategy and tactics of moving forward. I'm often of late is quoting a renowned philosopher, Mike Tyson, and his discussion of leadership. He said that everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. Now he's talking about strategy, that plan there. If you plan without any kind of conception of who you're up against or what you're up against, you're going to get punched in the mouth. You're going to get defeated. And much of the activities of a lot of our young leaders who are emerging, they have no concept of who we're up against. There's some general reference to poverty, some general reference to capitalism, and there's anti-capitalism and so on, but there's no assessment of what are the forces at play and what are they doing today and how are they preparing for tomorrow? What are their weak points so that we can strike a blow at those weak points? And how can we take a fractured motion and skirmishes that are beginning to emerge and coagulate them into a force that can rally the rest of the people? How can we do that? What are the vulnerabilities of this tremendous media monopoly that the powers that be has in terms of mainstream media? And I think this new technological revolution is making available to us social media that we can take advantage of, but largely still people reference major media and they have control of that. How do we deal with that? And what is it that we do today? What is it that we can do today? It's clear that when we make an assessment at this initial period of the movement, we can't outmask the powers that be. We can't outmoney them, certainly, and we certainly can't outmight them. We can't outmaneuver them if we're smart about it. We understand the stages of development of a process and do what is necessary in that stage. This stage of development is part of the understanding. The stage of development is part of the art of leadership, the art of possible, the art of strategy and tactics. You wouldn't tell a mother upon her finding out initially that she's pregnant. You wouldn't tell her to lay on a bed and start pushing as if she could have a baby at that early stage of development. You understand that that's the beginning stage, and there's stages after that. You understand what's needed at each stage, and then you strike a blow and concentrate your effort at that particular stage. But that takes analysis. That takes strategic dialogue. That takes thinking. Not just doing, but even what you do, you use what you do, your experiences, to understand what you're up against even more. So this relationship between consciousness and conditions of practice and theory of thinking and doing is absolutely tied up with the art of leadership, of the art of the possible. So that's the second point I want to raise. I should say with the situation at the point at which I burnt out was this situation where I had no perspective and again, no analysis. So then to say, well, I'm going to do this. I'm going to concentrate on these things and not concentrate on those things, realizing that it affect the forces that we're up against. That's a level of sophistication that we have to reach if we're going to win. And the whole point is to win. The point is not to fight the good fight. I hear a lot of people talking about let's fight the good fight. Man, forget that, man. We're talking about winning. And to win means to understand what you're up against and what you're dealing with and what your strength is that you can concentrate against the strength of the powers that be. And they have vulnerability. Every colossus in history has always had a foot of clay. But until we can find out what is the man behind that curtain, you know, we're not going to be able to influence and really move the situation. And the art of leadership is about moving the situation. It's about strategy and tactics. It's about understanding what Mike Tyson says, is that you're up against a foe. We're not just planning to walk across the street with no opposition. We're planning against plans. We're mapping a strategy that is essentially a counter strategy against who we're up against. And that has to be understood. So the art of the possible, the art of leadership, the art of strategy and tactics was the second point. The third point has to do with the question of why the title is not enough to be angry. There's a lot of angry going around today, and people have a lot to be angry about. And that anger is going to grow, no doubt, as the conditions, at least the pattern as they're showing themselves, continues to unfold. During the uprisings in the 60s, there were tremendous anger. And the fact of the matter is that we had no organization during that period. The only organizations that were able to respond was the organization I spoke to. And that was the political police, you know, that was clearly directed by the powers that be. And there was the movement and organization around Ronald Reagan and these forces that was able to use that. And I should also say the Black Muslim. I think that needs to be studied because the Black Muslims during that period, coming off the leadership of Malcolm X in terms of strategy and tactics and how they were building their movement at that time, they were in the heart of these ghettos. And they did programs and conducted themselves in such a way as to deal with the immediate needs of the people in those ghettos who eventually erupted. And so unlike the NAACP or the Urban Leagues and all these other Black organizations, it was the Black Muslims that was most prepared and most best positioned to absorb a rapid membership growth. So I think looking at those responses, but overall, there was no consciousness, there was no organization, there was that the organizers had no idea of how do you deal with this breakout of activity on that level. We were all caught with our pants down, really. I mean, you know, and when this thing broke, it was just total surprise. Not only we, a good element of media was caught with their pants down because they helped spread the uprisings during the 60s. And, you know, they've learned from it since then is that people are still hurting, but they're not going to have the media be used in such a way as to ignite, have it ignited elsewhere. And we got to take that into account in terms of this new media revolution that we have to take a hold of and figure out how we want to use that media in order to build our movement. But to organize, you have to first organize the organizers. You got to organize the people who are going to do the organizing. Now, this is a relationship between quantity and quality. This is a relationship between what's in physics is this whole relationship of direction, mass, and velocity. Let me get into that because there is that relationship. And our consciousness, we seem to see these things in categories, and therefore we don't see the inner relationship to it. That if we have people who are capable of understanding the art of the possible, their leadership, those few people can ignite a movement. But they got to understand very deeply. They got to be very intelligent and sophisticated, not just with a lot of sentimentalism, which a lot of people think that's enough. We got the sentimentalism, we're right, we're morally correct, and so we'll reduce the whole notion of strategy and leadership to morality. Since we're right, let's just go do it, as opposed to really thinking this thing through and having to identify the strategic points, the most important points, having leaders to do that is very important. In physics, every movement, every motion in physics has to start with some assessment of direction before it deals with the questions of mass and velocity. If you get on the train, and this is enough physics, if you get on a train thinking that you're going to Chicago and the train is actually going to Atlanta, Georgia, you're going to go to Atlanta, Georgia. I don't care how much you're thinking you're going to Chicago. You got to get on the right train. Direction is very important. So if you're in a train going to the opposite place that you want to go, and you have a lot of mass, you have a lot of velocity, but you're going in the wrong direction. So the first point of any process is this point of direction and this relationship, therefore, to mass and velocity. We got to figure this thing out because our consciousness is that things got to get big as if they're going to get big. How are they going to get big? They're going to get big because those of us who are making real commitments are going to make it big. It's going to be able to make it big based on our being able to not miss the moment, to understand what conditions people are lapsed into passivity and what conditions do people are evoked into massive activity and how we are able to sustain and position ourselves to actually coordinate and channel that massive activity that is generated not just through our conversation. There's another point made in the essay, not through our great organizing and our speaking all over the place, but it's also it's something that has to be developed in relationship to what the conditions makes possible. At a certain point, people are not going to allow their kids in mass. The people are not going to allow their kids and their family to go hungry or without. They're going to fight just like they did during the 30s, like they did during the 20s, and like they did during the 90s, the 1800s. These were periods in which there was massive economic shifts and technological shifts and so forth that took place. And that, I should say, that part of the conditions that I think we have to take note of is this tremendous technological development that's taking place is unprecedented. This is the real core of our discussion, that we're not living during, you know, the 1800s and so on. We're living now, and this is this shift in the conditions are creating two major forces right now. One, the poor and dispossessed, and the other one is this concentration of big capital that's being globalized. You have these two forces, and all the other forces, the middle strata, are being pearled into the position, largely owing to the technological development in the estimate of the book. And so as leaders that's trying to organize, we have to take those possibilities into account. We have to line up with reality.
So can I say, this is Colleen Wessel McCoy again. We have a little bit of time left. If folks who are here, and there's actually 45 of us on the call today, but we want to do have time for people to raise questions and Willie to respond. So if you could use the chat bar, if on the lower right corner, there's a little rectangle, a little call out rectangle. If you select that, a chat bar comes up on the right side of the screen and you can send questions there, send questions to Willie.
Sure.
And so I'll let him make his fourth point while people are sending questions. And then the conversation certainly can continue beyond this webinar. So please start to send questions.
Okay, the last and final point that I want to make here is the necessity of understanding these two basic forces that are being created in society today. The growth of the poor and dispossessed, and the dismantling of the so-called middle class, and the need to unite those forces who have no choice but to fight to end the status quo. The status quo is killing them. Now, every year, anywhere between 130,000 to 250,000 people die because of poverty in one way or another. And that includes police brutality, but it outweighs more people die of hunger worldwide than they die of wars. I mean, this process is happening. So there's a certain urgency of us to unite the dispossessed because it's in their interest to move the situation. But to unite them, you got to have leaders. You got to get the leaders together in strategic dialogue. Now, the point that I want to raise around the unity of the dispossessed and having leaders who really fight like hell to unite them is this call by the Carroll Center, the Poverty Initiative, which I strongly endorse and suggest people look into it, is this this campaign and call to reignite the Reverend Dr. King's Poor People's Campaign, that the conditions that he was dealing with in the 60s are conditions that are here again, but they're on a much worse situation, and it's much it's globalized. In Europe, United States, the global South, we're finding dislocations happening everywhere, and it's finding every manifestation. And so we're seeing that the struggles that are breaking out are skirmishes, and they're very separated. You know, there's a struggle around water over here. There's a struggle around Fight for 15 over here. There's a struggle around police brutality there. There's the immigrant struggle. There's the struggle around women equality. There's mass incarceration. There's evictions. You have all these struggles that are breaking out all over the country and all over the world, but they're fragmented. So the idea of the Poor People's Campaign is this question of the unity of the poor and dispossessed, so that they can become a rallying point of what Martin Luther King called a new and unsettling force that can become a rallying point for the masses of the people. Because the problems that the poor is facing today is not a problem of charity, it's a problem that is affect the whole direction of society. I'm poor or homeless today, you can be poor and homeless tomorrow. And if you're not affected like that, you're at least affected morally in terms of your concept of life, of human life and decency. Those things are all being thrown into crisis right now. And the way out right now is that the people who are hurting, who are most hurting, need to be at the forefront of these problems. And I think all of history affirms that when the forces that are most affected are brought to the forefront of a problem that defines a historical period, that historical period is able to go to a development forward, that society is better. The struggle against the British Crown had to be led by the colonies. I mean, there was involvement of the Spanish, there was involvement of the French. They played a very important role, but it had to be the colonists that had to be organized to rally the sentiments, even in Britain, as well as Spain, as well as the rest of the country, in order to bring a successful solution. The struggle for women's suffrage, can you imagine that movement being led by men? It has to be led by the people who are most affected. Well, today we're dealing with this problem of the growth of poverty on the one hand, and the growth of in the concentration and growth of wealth on the other hand. And the people who are in a position to do something about it is the people who are hurting. But you need leaders who understand that. And we need to bring leaders together who can then can fight for a commitment, a clarity, a connectedness, and a competence in terms of strategy and tactics where we can deal with coagulating and organizing this anger and making that anger an effective force through that organization. That's what this is what the book is trying to put out there for debate and discussion.
So Willie, we've gotten some great questions. Okay. One from Lindsay, can you recommend a documentary film on the Watts riots? What's the best place to get history there?
Now we've collected some stuff here. If you Google Watts riot, you go to the YouTube, there's some coverage, you get a feel for it. In terms of analysis and description, there's a book called Rivers of Blood and Years of Darkness by Connaught. It's spelled C-O-N-O-T, author. I don't know if it's still, but this is a real blow-by-blow description of what went down. You get a real feel for what all the forces that the main forces that were at play during that riot. So that uprising. I would read that. I would read also Dr. King's piece, Nonviolence and Social Change, and his Massey lectures. One of the lectures is on the uprising. I would read his stuff. In terms of, again, media, I would recommend some of the documentaries that are online, because we've used those documentaries. So I would just suggest that.
Kareem has asked about the role of gender in this history and work, pointing out that it's a very popular critique of movements in the 60s, particularly among young queer leftists that are new to organizing. So curious about how you think about gender and struggles in the past and present.
Well, I think the greatest hero in our country's history is Harriet Tubman. I mean, people don't understand what the intelligence of this lady and the bravery and what she'd done in terms of being at the spearhead of one of the most earth-shaking movements in the history of this country. That is the ending of slavery and the Reconstruction period. I think the role of women, because and people who are saddled with different forms of oppression, like women who are poor, especially they are exploited, they are discriminated against as women. Of color, they're oppressed racially, and if you're queer, you're oppressed for that. So if you find someone that brings those things into play, you'll find that they are in a position, generally speaking, to play a leading role. I think in history, there's no accident that people who are suffering from triple and four times oppression are in a better position to fight and lead the struggle to end the status quo than the people who don't suffer from that. So I think the role of the economic exploitation, people who are oppressed for all the other reasons combined, and those who embody that, and particularly I think the role of women have been critical, especially I've had a good fortune, the Kinston Werfel Rights Union, I was 10 years the education director there, and that organization and his war council, that's our leadership body, was mostly women. If you look at the KROs and the Poverty Initiative, most of our leaders are women. And I think that gives us stability and direction because of the fact of the experience that women has that are different from males. So any movement that's going to have any kind of sustainability has got to make room for women in their leadership development and their leadership. We're just going to lose. And what's the point if it's not to win?
So Sarah asks, how do we use technology when it has given way to such passive complacency with the current generation?
That's a good question, because what's happening because of the passivity is that the powers that be have mastered the media, and we haven't. A media that we have at our disposal, even if we're dispossessed and poor, through our organizing, we have access to it. And therefore, we could communicate on a level global that we've never been able to communicate. Now, there was a gentleman by the name of Zbigniew Brzezinski. He was the national security advisor for Carter, and he is a noted leader, political strategist. And when he talks, he's like E.L. Hutton. When he talks, everybody listens. His recent book called Strategic Vision, which is what I recommend people read. We got to read what these people are saying, man. Got to know what they're saying. But one of the things he recognized was that the role of the media in the process is very important. Now, what he did, he only drew out the experience in terms of the use of media in terms of transferring tactical experience. I think our use of media today has to be about how do we engage people strategically, have strategic dialogues, so that as our use of the media is challenged, we have people who have a basic strategic unity, so that even if they're not in contact with each other for time on end, they are able to move on the same strategy. I mean, if our strategy is definitely to get to Rome, then the people who are coming from the West and coming from the East or coming from the North and South, they understand that strategy and they figure out the tactics from where they're coming from. They can't have the same tactic coming from the East as coming from the West, but they have the same strategy in terms of all roads leads to Rome. And if we can generate that kind of discussion through this advanced media, then we're talking about a level of organizing and a level of unity that matches our time and meets the requirements of our time in terms of the global character of the process. This is what the essay is talking about, is arguing. This is where we're going to have debates. But if your assessment of the enemy is the wrong assessment, then your tactics, especially your tactics and use of the media, is going to be wrong. If you think what we're up against is a teddy bear, when in fact we're up against a grizzly bear, then you're in trouble, you know, with the media or anything that you're going to use. But the media is very important in terms of communication and organizing, especially on the scale that we have to organize and communicate at this point.
So unfortunately, I want to honor the time that we allotted and promise that we will have more webinars in the future. I want to give a thanks to Left Roots for allowing us to use this web platform. And please do send feedback about the content, the form, the technology, the time, things like that, so that we can make this something that works for everyone and continue to use this as a way of study and leadership development.
Yeah, and I want to thank everybody for listening, you know, hearing me. And I'm hoping that we get some responses and love to hear some of your thinking about what has been talked about today. Yeah.
I also want to encourage folks, if you haven't already, that the book, the ebook is available on Amazon.com. It's Not Enough to Be Angry. If you're looking for more, Willie has another book written with others called Pedagogy of the Poor. That's also available on Amazon if you look under Willie Baptist. And then there are study materials on the Cairo Center website under resources. And then I encourage everyone to visit poorpeoplescampaign.org to learn more about the proposed campaign and to add your name and the name of your organization as endorsers of the call, and to find ways to make this work yours and to make this the work that you're doing and the battles you're waging part of building this campaign and shaping this campaign and moving this forward, moving this movement forward. So please be in touch with us through email and through the website and through Facebook. And I feel like this was a great success and a very, very exciting conversation. And so I look forward to continued conference calls and webinars. So thanks everyone for being here.